All right, good evening.
Good evening.
Let's turn on over to Hebrews 7. And somebody left a Band-Aid up here, just so y'all know. So who's ever needs a Band-Aid, or you got a Band-Aid up there. But we're in Hebrews chapter 7. Yeah. We're not that far. We need to go, let's start actually going 1 through 12. We're going to go Hebrews 7, 1 through 12. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, king of righteousness, and then also king of Salem, which is king of peace. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually. Now observe how great this man was, to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of his choicest spoils, and who, those indeed of the sons of Levi, who received the priest's office, have commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their brethren, although these are descended from Abraham. But the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises. But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. In this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case, one receives them, of whom it is witnessed that he lives on. And so to speak, though through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Now, perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it, people received the law. What further need was there for another priest to arise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron? For when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of law also. All right, perfect. So we're going to, last week I actually covered a lot of what we're going to cover today, but it was more of a surface level of Hebrews chapter 7. It was kind of just getting you the whole idea. But what we're really going to talk about, we're not going to talk about Melchizedek. We talked about Melchizedek last time. Hopefully you guys came to some kind of conclusion on Melchizedek. I'm not sure if I covered every single aspect of it, but hopefully you come to your own conviction. But we're going to keep on going here. And really, what I kind of ended with last week is what I want you to really remember this week as well. If you get anything out of Hebrews 7 here in the beginning, just get this one thing, at least in the first part of Hebrews 7, and that is that Levi is under Abraham, and that Abraham is under Melchizedek. You guys remember that beautiful picture I had, this beautiful diagram I had up on the board? Yeah, Melchizedek, Abraham, and then Levi. So that's really what he's driving home, at least in these first verses. And really, the first part of Hebrews 7 is actually not really too hard to follow. I would argue it's pretty straightforward, right? He's just telling, he's going to argue that Jesus is from a greater priesthood. And so he starts by saying there was an old Levitical priesthood, but the old Levitical priesthood was not as good as Melchizedek's priesthood. So by the order of Melchizedek, Jesus is high priest, which would make sense. He's just building this case. So, we'll kind of go through some of this. So, just some comments. I do want to hit a couple things I didn't get to last week as much as I would have liked to. I didn't know if you guys had any comments. It looked like there were some people, at least one or two, who had some comments. So I'm going to open up with you guys being able to make some comments off of some stuff where we left off last time. I just wanted to also mention, which I did mention this last time, but it says, Melchizedek was made like the Son of God. Now, again, I mean, we as Christians, we are being made into the image of Christ, right? But that's because of Christ's power at work within us, amen? And we are clothed in Christ. So this Melchizedek guy just comes along, and he says he doesn't have genealogy, he has no beginning of days, no end of life, And yeah, he's made like the Son of God. Now, do y'all remember what I mentioned that some people actually, a fair amount of people will actually say Melchizedek, he was not Jesus, right? He's not Jesus. A lot of people will say that. Do you guys remember what I said last week about how they'll address the genealogy and he has no beginning of days or end of life? Do you remember how I said most people will approach that? It's been a long week. I get that. It's untraceable, yeah. So basically, a lot of people will argue there was no genealogy, and he's mentioning there's no genealogy, and there's no birth certificates, there's no death record, right? So basically what they were trying to say is, it wasn't important, or there was no found record. But my rebuttal to that would be, why would he even mention this in the first place, right? Why was he making a point that there's no genealogy or beginning of days or end of life? Let me get a couple comments here.
I remember you said you wanted me to bring it up this week, and this is the one that I would throw back at him, is that it says in verse 3 he remains a priest perpetually, which basically means forever. And the whole context of this chunk of scripture is building a case ultimately up to Jesus Christ, because when we get down into the 20s, we're specifically talking about Jesus Christ. And when it talks about Jesus Christ, it says in verse 23 and 24, the former priests existed in greater numbers, but they were prevented by death from continuing. Jesus, on the other hand, because he continues forever, holds his priesthood permanently. So Jesus has his priesthood permanently, and Melchizedek has his priesthood permanently. And if permanently meant forever with Jesus, it probably means with Melchizedek, so how could he die? Thus, he's either Jesus or we've got something weird going on. So that would be my argument.
Yeah, I guess in that would be an interesting picture that they have, is that Melchizedek is serving as a high priest at that point, and then Jesus comes up. Now we have two priests that are serving perpetually.
It says forever.
Right.
And it specifically says the Levitical priesthood were kept from serving as priests because they died.
Right. So, yeah, we'll cover that a little bit. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up.
I also look at the fact that he's important enough to be brought up several times throughout the book of Hebrews. He was brought up in Genesis when Abraham actually paid him the tithe and they said who he was. The Old Testament is very strong with genealogy. So if there's no genealogy listed for him, that could only mean one thing, because you don't just appear out of nowhere unless you're God, Jesus.
Yeah, there's something that's going on there.
Right.
Good point.
And that's one of the things that I've often kind of wondered about, this interaction that Abraham has with Melchizedek, as recorded in Genesis 14. It leads me to believe that this was not the first time that Abraham had ever seen Melchizedek, because otherwise, why would he, all of a sudden, this guy shows up and offers a peace offering, and here's 10% of everything, or, you know, a tithe of all the best stuff. So it's conjecture, of course, but I think based upon the circumstances, it would seem that Abraham had some sort of familiarity with him.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Melchizedek's not mentioned before in the context of all the kings. There's like 10 of them, you know, there's 4 and 5, and there's a lot of them mentioned, and then he just shows up. So, yeah. Any other comments? Any other opening comments? Well, the one that was really... I heard this from a handful of people. They came back and I was really, really happy about this, actually. Hopefully I don't bore you all to sleep. So it was good to see that there was some people that heard what I was saying. But that's not on you. That's on me if I'm just too, monotone. But, the priests perpetually, right? This one is really hard to get around. Priest perpetually, what does that sound like? Well, he's going to talk about this even at the end of chapter 6. Remember, he's a priest forever. Jesus is a priest forever by the order of Melchizedek. There's Melchizedek, and he's a priest perpetually. And so what you can really see why the writer of Hebrews is bringing Melchizedek in here, though. And that's really what I want. Hopefully, if you learn anything through this class on chapter 7 in this first part, is that he's bringing Melchizedek up. Because in the mind of a Jew, think about these Hebrew people, even in the Pharisee world, right? Who wrote the Torah, the first five books? Moses wrote the first five books. Now, actually, it would be customary for them to memorize these. So lots of the Jewish people, they had this down. They would understand a lot of the scripture, especially the first five books of Moses. So whenever the writer of Hebrews is actually using Melchizedek, it's going to just resonate with a lot of them, right? Also, they had Jewish, I guess, tradition on who they thought Melchizedek was as well. They had their own tradition. But generally, think about being a Jewish person. Try to put yourself in those shoes. And now he's starting to mention Melchizedek. And they would be thinking, yeah, he does show up there. And he says he was a king of righteousness, right? Yeah. His name means king of peace. Yeah. Oh, he was a priest as well of the Most High God. All of these things, he's really bringing it to their attention. So what he's saying is that there was a priestly order before Aaron, before the Levitical priesthood. And it was so significant, which we're going to cover here in a second. It was so significant that even Abraham gave to this priest. So you can see what he's really doing. I actually have written down on here. Let's read verse 4 and then I'll kind of tell you this interesting. I don't know if it's a good example or not, but verse 4, "Now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of the choicest spoils." The word there for observe means to look. So it's like if, I don't know if you've ever experienced this before, you're busy doing something and you know you're working on something and you have a little, I'm thinking of a little kid more than an adult, but sometimes, you know, adults do this as well. Somebody comes in, they're like, "Look, you know, look, look, take a look at this," right? And you're like, "I'm busy right now, just give me a second." But they're like, "No, I want you to see this, observe this," right? That's really, that word means that. It says, "Now observe." What he's saying is, now look at this, think about this, observe how great this man was. Remember, we're putting ourselves in the shoes of being a Hebrew, a Jewish-backgrounded person, and he's telling them, he's saying, think about, you remember Melchizedek? Yes, that does ring a bell. Yes, I remember Genesis. He says, now observe. I want you to look at this. Think about how great he was. He's really trying to get their attention with this. And the reason why is because, you know, you guys know what patriarch means, right? Abraham, it means big papa, right? He's the big dad, right? The patriarch. Abraham is the top, right? He's the father of us all, Paul says in Romans. So he says, this guy was so great, Melchizedek was so great, that even Abraham, the patriarch, gave him a tenth of the choicest spoils. Now this is where I'm going to kind of go off a little bit in... I have an example and then another. We're going to talk about the spoils in a second. But I have just Michael Jordan written down. And the reason why is because in every field, every realm of sports or whatever, there's always somebody who is revered as the best, right? So there's always somebody, Tom Brady of the football, right? Oh, I heard a hoot. Tom Brady is way up here, right? I'm not going to say he is the best, okay, because that's a whole nother discussion. Sorry, Damien. But he could be. Also, could be Patrick Mahomes pretty soon here, but I'm not going to go into that. But you know you're good when people like Patrick Mahomes, even these new people who are pretty decent, they're coming in and then they're saying, well, he is good, but is he as good as so-and-so? And I couldn't help but just think of Michael Jordan. If you think about Michael Jordan, he was significant because he was a good player. He got the championships. He won, right? He was a winner. But also what he did for the sport was much more than just, there were lots of great players before him, but Michael Jordan did a lot for the sport as a whole. So he, in a way, would be very significant. So to a Jew, I mean, this whole thing is, That example maybe is not perfect, but think about something in your field and think about somebody who is the person, like Michael Jordan, because even LeBron James comes along later. He's an NBA player. He's not good at all. But LeBron James comes along, and now people are saying, yeah, he's really good, but we still have to compare him to Michael Jordan because Michael Jordan is kind of like the standard, right? And people understand that, even in other countries. I mean, people will spend a ton of money even in the Philippines for Jordans. It's kind of interesting. But Abraham is like that guy to a Jew. Okay, he is the top. He's the patriarch. And so then they hear, and that's why he's telling them to take a look at this. Take a look. This guy is above Abraham. See how great a man he was. So Abraham, being as great as he was, what did he give to Melchizedek? Yeah, he gave him, and I believe in Genesis says a tenth of all. So a tenth of the choicest spoils. Now, what just happened in the context, we're not going to go back to Genesis, but what happened in the context of Genesis 14? You might remember the Cheddar King. Remember, Abraham had to go rescue Lot. And so there was battle. He got 318 of his men out of his household, trained in his own household, and he goes and he rescues them. So he had just come back from battle, so he actually had accumulated quite a bit of spoils, right? This would be precious metals. It could be weaponry. It could be vehicles, right? Lots of different things. So he's accumulating all of this stuff. I kind of debated how much I want to go off and talk about tithing a little bit, but I'm just going to mention it here because I don't really know when I will mention it in the future. Yeah, anybody know what tithing means? To tithe? To tithe is from the word 10, right? So that's why they'll say to tithe is to give a tenth. The Jewish people were to tithe, right? They were to give a tenth to the priests, right? Actually, Levites as well. I think it was every third year, but we'll get to that in a second. They were to give a tenth. Another thing I want to clarify, though, on the tithe. Notice it says Abraham didn't give a tenth of his bank account. It said he gave a tenth of his choicest spoils. So with tithing, oftentimes, not always, but this is often that your tithing would be whatever you had to bring to the table, right? So the way I think of it is, if you have a piece of pie or a piece of pizza, I don't know, whatever you prefer, I think about a pizza, right? And I think about it's divided into 10 pieces. Now everybody knows that there's a piece that you're going to go for first, right? There's always a piece that you want to go for first. And if somebody says, "Can I have one of your pieces?" you just slyly turn the piece the other way. So they can take one of the smaller ones, right? If my wife says, "You can have one of my pieces, my leftover pieces on my pizza," I always know I'm going to be reaching for the bigger one. No. I actually do that sometimes, but I know that's because she wants me to eat as much as I can of her stuff. So, but anyways, yeah, there's a principle that these things are more than just, it's not like you get $1,000 every month and then you give $100. It was much more than that, right? It's like you have 10 pieces of pie, this is what your food is, and then you give your best piece of food. It's like Abraham just went to war, and he did. He got 10 vehicles, right? There were 10 of them. And they were obviously bigger, they were smaller, and there were various shapes and sizes, and he took the best one, and he said, "Yeah, that Ferrari, I'm going to give this to Melchizedek. I'm not giving him the old, you know, 1980 something that doesn't work, Oldsmobile," right? Maybe those are good, I don't know. But he's giving him the choicest of the things. And so on the thought process of tithing, I just wanted to reiterate this. When Abraham gives to God, he's not giving just something that's, you know, "Oh, I'm just going to give you some of this," or whatever. He's giving a tenth of the choicest things. He's giving the best. And like I said, I'm not going to go too far down the tithing road, but you can see all of the spiritual things that tie in nowadays as well. Jared.
I think it's interesting in this whole discussion on tithing and whatnot, that in verse 5 it says, "And those indeed of the sons of Levi, priesthood, who receive the priest's office, have commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their brethren, all these are descended from Abraham. But the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth, from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises." So on the one hand, the priests, you were commanded in the law, this is how much you must give. I don't see anywhere in this reference, whether it's in Genesis or Psalm, 110, obviously there's no mention there of tithes, or here, that it was a requirement. That Abraham was like, oh, that's right, I owe you the 10%. He gave willingly of the choicest spoils. Big difference between the Old Testament system and, well, a big difference between the law and the law of faith.
Yeah. Excellent point. That's why Abraham is spoken so highly of. Any other comments? Yeah. No, I think it's really important that we do take a little bit of time to just look at that. I'm not even really more than I'm spinning on it right now, but yeah, faith, really, it was always about what God wanted. And so, where I was kind of also going with this is that it was also meant to be your livelihood, okay? If you spent your whole life raising sheep, and you raised a bunch of sheep, right? You would take, and you had 10 sheep. Let's say you raised 10 sheep. You took the best sheep that you had, and you gave that to the Lord, right? That would be the thing that you would give to the Lord. It wouldn't just be, this sheep. You know, God was very specific. He said, I don't want three-legged sheep, right? I don't want sheep with defects. I don't want things with defects. He wanted these things to be the best. But it was also, that's why I'm saying it's not just a bank account. See, it's a lot easier. We can become kind of numb, right? Well, the church, not that we're told in the New Testament to give a tenth, okay? I'm not going to tell you that he says to give a tenth. But the principle, as Jared brought up, is that Abraham did by faith. He would have given a lot more if Melchizedek asked him to, but he was just graciously giving. But, so with money now, it gets a little bit harder. It can almost become more of a convenience, right? I make $1,000 a month, and then I just give a tenth. I just give $100, right? That's what somebody... And when you think of it that way, it might be kind of heartless, almost, okay? In these scenarios, lots of times they would be giving of their own livelihood, the animal that they actually worked hard and raised. They actually develop a relation. Maybe they really like this one. This is their choicest ox, right? But they're giving it to the Lord. So there's more behind that, and it implies that you're actually putting effort into it as well. And so where this kind of, I believe, ties over into new creation as well is that it's not just about marking out a certain dollar amount that I'm going to give to the congregation. It's about your livelihood, 10% of your time, right? It's more than 10%, really, but why don't we give of our time, our effort, right? The things that we have. He gave a 10% of the choice of spoils. Well, I can give 10% of all the things I have, right? That was Abraham's mindset. He said, I'll give a tenth of everything, right? I'll give whatever you want. Like Melchizedek, you want something from the vehicles department? And Abraham had lots. He said, I'll give you that. You want something from whatever. And so really, it transcends. It's just more than just money is what I'm trying to get at. It wasn't just about money. It was about really giving of what you can offer to God. That's really, really what God wants from us. He wants our heart. And it's the choicest things.
Just really appreciate the last thing you said there. Even from a worldly perspective, there isn't a wealth-generating advocate or a passive income coach that isn't teaching people to give. And even from a worldly perspective, not even faith or scripture or thanking Jesus for what you have or being the root of all sorts of evil, or your heart is, you know, your where your treasure is. All that aside, even the world understands that acquiring wealth and not turning around and sharing it is vanity. It's nothing. So even the people out there who are amassing billions in passive income and building businesses, they're coaching the next generation. Make sure you give, give, give.
Yeah, there's so many things that I could go up on that. And so really it's how does this translate now? What can you offer now from whatever your livelihood may be, your job, your vehicle situation, your housing situation? What can you really do? What can you really give? And so Abraham, he's not told to do this, as Jared mentioned, but he does it anyways. Now, what the writer of Hebrews is trying to really communicate is that Abraham, being the patriarch, he is obviously putting a lot of emphasis on Melchizedek, because he doesn't do this to anybody else. It's Melchizedek. Melchizedek is very important. That's what he's trying to get across. And you guys understand that, but I just want us to see really where he's going with this. So the fact that Abraham gave shows the importance of Melchizedek. But there's another aspect of this as well, which we'll get to a little bit later. And I think Jared might have alluded to it a little bit. But yeah, let's just keep reading. So verse 5, "And those indeed of the sons of Levi who receive the priest office have commandment in the law to collect the tenth from the people, that is from their brethren. Although these are descended from Abraham." So we're not going to spend too much time on that. He's just reminding them, the Levitical priests, right? They also receive tithes from their brethren. Now, the brethren are the other tribes as well. And the he clarifies, and this is where, like, hopefully I don't lose too many of you, but he is clarifying. He's saying, even though the Levites, even though the Levitical priests receive tithes from the other people, the other tribes, their brethren, they're also descended from Abraham. Okay? So I'll kind of draw this up on the board because I think it's easier to see it sometimes. You have Abraham, right? And he is the great-grandfather of Levi, right? Which becomes the tribe of Levi. But it's kind of like all squares are rectangles, but not all rectangles are squares, right? All Levites are not priests, but all priests were Levites. So, what is that called, a Venn diagram? Am I crazy? It kind of looks something like this. So this is Levi, and these are the priests, right? All priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. Hopefully this is not too confusing. But what he's really getting at is that they received from the other tribes, they received tithes from their brethren. Their brethren gave them tithes to Levi, and more specifically to the priest. The priests were receiving these tithes. They got a tenth, and they needed it because they didn't have an inheritance like the rest of them. But what he says is, although even Levi, even the priest, all of them, all of these guys together are still sons of Abraham. They're all still sons of Abraham. So even if you want to make it a hierarchy, I'm not drawing a pyramid scheme, okay? Even if you want to make it a hierarchy, he's saying that the Levites are above their brethren, the priests, actually. He's saying the priests, they actually are, if you want to make a hierarchy, they're receiving tithes from their brethren, so really they're being honored more than their brethren. But it doesn't matter if the Levites are above all of the other tribes, because all of them, even including the priests, are still under Abraham. Now remember who Abraham is giving to. Who is Abraham giving the choices of his spoils to? Well, let's do this a different color. Abraham, at the very top, is giving to Melchizedek. So Melchizedek, what he's saying is really, you can see what he's really getting at. Melchizedek is way above all of them. And the example that he talks about is that when you give. So there's also the The other aspect of this, which Jared mentioned, is when we give, and this is actually something that Nolan alluded to, when we give, we also get, right? And that's why people are teaching that you got to give, you got to give. If you're given a lot, you got to give, whatever that looks like. If you're giving of your time, if you're given lots of free time, what should you be giving? Give of your time, right? If you're given extra money, then what could you be giving? Help people who need help with money. If you're given great health, if you're given whatever you have, the idea is that you give back. So when the people, when they would give to the Levitical priest, those other tribes, when they would give to the priest, what would the priest in turn give back to them? And I think it mentions it here in verse 5. Oh, no. Wait. It doesn't. Sorry. They would actually be, in turn, the priest would be doing service for the people. They would actually be able to instruct the people. They were bringing blessings to the people as well. And so that's the correlation. In verse 6, it says, "But the one whose genealogy is not traced from them," so it's going to be Melchizedek. Melchizedek is not from Abraham, right? Melchizedek is above on our diagram. "The one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham," we discussed that, "and blessed the one who had the promises." So, one indicator that Melchizedek is greater than Abraham is that Abraham gave to Melchizedek, right? That's, if you see Abraham giving to Melchizedek, you can draw the conclusion Melchizedek is greater. But another indicator that Melchizedek is above Abraham is in verse 7. "But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater." Have you ever seen, well, I guess there might be some examples, but generally, do you see the lesser, like a son, going before their father in their old age and blessing them? Or would you more likely see the father blessing his children before he leaves? And this is the biblical principle, right? Time and time again, the older would bless. You know, Isaac would bless. All these guys would go and they would bless their descendants. So this is another indicator that Abraham is less, he's lesser than Melchizedek. Because it said Melchizedek blessed Abraham. All of these things are just, he's just really building this strong case. So let's go to verse 8. "In this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case," the mortal men are the Levitical priests, "in that case being Melchizedek," notice it's singular now. He says, "in that case, one receives them." So under the old covenant, there were lots of priests, right? They were prevented by death from continuing and continuing and continuing. They were mortal. But he says, on the other hand, Melchizedek's priesthood, he receives them, and it goes on and even says, "of whom it is witnessed that he lives on." So remember earlier what we talked about in opening, Melchizedek's priesthood is held for how long? Perpetually, forever, right? That's the communication. So Melchizedek, he lives on, we get to see here. And so to speak, verse 9, "through Abraham, even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes." So, again, this is all, hopefully I'm not overcomplicating it, but it's pretty simple. What he's basically saying is just a reiteration of what he's been saying the whole time. When Abraham was paying tithes to Melchizedek, and I'll do dollar signs, even though I said that's not really a good indicator, but you know, there's lots of this stack of cash. When Abe is giving Melchizedek the cash, right? He's giving him the money, and he's giving him tithes, really, because he loves him and he respects him. He's giving honor to him. What the writer of Hebrews is also saying, he's saying it's also Levi who's paying tithes to Melchizedek through his father Abraham. So it's kind of like Levi is paying tithes to Melchizedek through his father Abraham, really. And the reason why that's important is because, remember, you only pay tithes to the one who has more honor, who is greater. So what the writer of Hebrews is doing is he's just beating this dead horse. He's driving this so many different ways. What he's really trying to do is the Jewish-minded person has to look at this and they have to draw the conclusion. Mind you, he's going back through the Old Testament and they have to draw the conclusion that, yeah, Melchizedek is greater than Levi. And this is even more specific. It's actually Melchizedek's priesthood is greater than the Levitical priesthood. You got a couple comments.
I think, while of course the writer of Hebrews at the time is dealing directly with the Jewish perspective, helping them understand that Melchizedek's priesthood had always existed and therefore had been and was and is superior to the law, helping the Jews understand it, this same idea is the only way that you can really convince someone who is a premillennialist that we are not going to go back to the law. Because this is also why, I was chatting with Sue about this, this is also why the Bible translators, like the New American Standard, because pretty much everywhere you see, like in verse 8 where it says 1, it should be capitalized. But this is why, like the New American Standard translators, don't do this, because in their minds, we're going to go back to something greater than what we have now, which in their minds is the law. Yeah. And if they understood Melchizedek, if they really allowed themselves to be honest about who Melchizedek was, they would see that premillennialism is a complete falsehood. So it's not just for them. It's certainly for us as well. And that's why the book of Hebrews can absolutely destroy premillennialism if you can get somebody to sit down and actually be honest about what it says.
Yeah, excellent point.
This kind of goes back to what you said at the beginning, but also a couple classes ago. So you started by saying, if you've gotten anything out of the beginning, just see that Melchizedek is above Abraham. So to Jared's point, you have to remember there's this Jewish audience, which is having a difficulty letting go of the law, right? It's about to pass away. The temple's going down. And so he's showing them that just because the Levitical priesthood came, it didn't change a priesthood that predated it. Yeah. So it's unchangeable. And then you're like, wow, what other place in the Bible has a Jewish audience that's trying to convince them that something else is unchangeable that isn't changed because of the giving of the law? Well, that's in Galatians 3. That the promises spoken to Abraham predate the law, and the law does not negate those promises. It's just an intercessing covenant, because the promises made to Abraham are unchangeable. So what did we learn was unchangeable from the chapter before? The promise and the priesthood. It's like the same thought just keeps going.
Yeah, this has been really, I've really enjoyed doing this class. I mean, hopefully it's not, like I said, sometimes I have a tendency to just really drive something home a lot, but I think it's the only way that I personally learn, though. That's how I learn. I have to hear it 5 times in a row, and then it's done. Like, once I got it, it's in there. But I have to just drive that in at first. And so that's really, really encouraging that you see, you're mentioning that there's these correlations in the scripture. He does the same exact thing, just drives the same principles time and time again. And then, Jared's point, excellent point, because I'm going to actually kind of make reference a little bit to it's they're named after me, okay? When I grew up in Colorado for a little while, I actually went to public school for a couple years, and my mom got these backpacks for my sister and I, and I think it was like second grade at the time, and she got our initials on her backpacks, Kendra's and mine. And Kendra's initials are KDS. I won't tell you her middle name, but it's Kendra in Serrano, obviously. That's what they were at the time. My middle initial, I don't know how many of you know my middle name, but I'm not really going to, I won't say it right now up front because I'll probably never hear the end of it. people ask me all the time, they're like, "What's Lorenzo Serrano, that's a cool name. You know, it's very Hispanic or whatever, Italian. I hear it all." But then they'll ask me, "What's your middle name then?" And I guess I'll just tell you. It's Douglas. So Lorenzo Douglas Serrano. And I'm proud of it because it's my dad's middle name, and now it's my son's middle name as well. So anyways, but my initials on my backpack were LDS, so it was just awkward. It was funny. So yeah, you can imagine like where people's minds go when they see LDS on your backpack. And but I want to talk about them just briefly here. notice, because you know, Jared mentioned false doctrine and different things, how this destroys false doctrine. The LDS, the Latter-day Saints, which are the Mormons, for those of you who may not know that, but LDS, Latter-day Saints, Mormon. Mormons, they have a really hard time with Hebrews 7 and 8. Very hard time, specifically with just the whole priesthood discussion, because there's really not any answers. It's just this flies absolutely in the face. We will probably discuss more of that as we go. But I wanted to just read something to you. The Mormons, I'm not going to teach you just Mormon philosophy real quick. I mean, I don't want to go in depth on this, but I'll teach you real quick. What the Mormons have is this weird structure where they have the Aaronic priesthood, they call it. And then I guess I should put Melchizedek on top, but they have Melchizedek priesthood and then they have Aaronic priesthood. And I've studied with a few Mormons. It's been interesting. But I'm going to read this definition for the Aaronic priesthood real quick. So they say the Aaronic priesthood is the lesser. This is actually kind of like a Wikipedia type answer, but it's the lesser of two orders of the priesthood recognized by the Latter-day Saints, unlike Melchizedek's priesthood, which is modeled after the authority of Jesus and the 12 apostles. So they have this really weird system, and we don't have time to go into all of it, but as far as I understand, somebody who's as young as like 10, 11, I don't want to put too many words in their mouth, I don't want to misrepresent, but basically a young person, maybe 11 or 12, they could become a priest by the order of Aaron. It's the Aaronic priest. They're a priest by the order of Aaron, okay? Don't ask me how that all works, because I don't know exactly how that all works. They don't either. I've asked a few of them. So by the order of Aaron, some 12-year-old is able to do priestly duties. And those priestly duties, I don't know if it's girls and boys. It's definitely boys. What they would do is they would go around and they're able to now serve in the congregation. So they might be able to partake in baptizing, or they will be able to serve communion. That was a big one I heard. They'll basically be able to serve communion, different things like that. But yeah, you get a 13-year-old boy who is a son of Aaron. He's a priest by the order of Aaron. Well, around 18, I believe. Again, I don't want to misrepresent. But around 18, basically, they get to a point where they can now become a part of the order of Melchizedek's priesthood. So, but I don't want to misrepresent. But I believe you have to go through this process. You have to go through the Aaronic priesthood before you can get to the priesthood of Melchizedek. And so there's actually this really iconic picture of Joseph Smith and somebody with him. And the angel, if I'm not mistaken, is basically making them priest of Aaron. He has his hand on their head and everything. Joseph Smith first was a priest of Aaron, and then he became a priest by the order of Melchizedek. The whole thing is just crazy, right? They also have 18-year-olds who are elders. But anyways, we're going to talk about this. We're going to pick this up next week because it's really important that we kind of discuss that at least to some length. You can't be a priest by the order of Aaron if you are not a descendant of Aaron. Yeah, it's not biblical, right? Yeah. Unless you have an extra book that tells you it's okay, then you're good. Okay? Another revelation. So we're gonna talk about that, but there's also a reason that I kind of brought that up as well. They're very keen on using this term Aaronic, which is, it's not really, I guess, a terrible one, but if you look through all of Hebrews chapter 7, I encourage you to do that tonight while it's still fresh on your mind. You can even probably do it right now, I guess. But you can look through there. You're not going to see, the writer of Hebrews is not talking about Aaronic. What is the priesthood that he keeps mentioning when he goes backwards? He mentions Levitical. He mentions Levitical. And this is going to be really important because this is where we're going to pick up next week, kind of why. Interesting stuff out there. This next part, the later part of chapter 7 and chapter 8 will really just destroy the Mormon whole priesthood. It just absolutely destroys it. So we'll kind of pick up there next time. And thanks, guys.